This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The headlines claim the economy is beginning its pandemic recovery, but it's not an even recovery for all Americans. So let's hear from one. Chelsea Horenstein, are you feeling the recovery yet?
Hi there, Meghna. We're seeing some promising signs in my business. I mean, acupuncturist, but it's we're not there yet, for sure.
Not there yet. Okay. Well, first of all, welcome to the show, Chelsea. Tell us a little bit more about yourself. You live in Queens. You're the mom of two. Tell us more about your family and your financial life right now.
Sure. I'm a mom of two, a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old. One of them in public school, the other one home with us. And I'm an acupuncturist, so that means self-employed, not a W-2 employee, sole proprietor. We're in a funny state right now, like many people, I'm sure, just not knowing what's on the other side of all of this. And for our jobs, there's always a bit of ebb and flow anyway, but right now there's definitely a bit more unsurety and uncertainty.
And I understand that you've got some heavy student loans hanging over your head.
Yes. So I went back for my master's, completed that back in 2014, and basically still dealing with a mountain of debt from that. And my partner as well, who's also an acupuncturist. So combined, we have a nice student loan chunk of debt.
And how much is it?
Oh, gosh, it sounds like such a staggering number to say out loud. So I'm looking at about 222, and my partner has about 169, somewhere in that range.
So more, if I'm doing my math right, that's more than $390,000?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So what do you want to know about how to feel, what you need to do to feel more sort of financially secure, even in these continuing times of uncertainty?
Yeah. So I guess for us, and maybe other people are in our shoes as well, we're at a crossroads where we currently live in an apartment, but we have been, even pre-pandemic, looking at buying a home. We have moved in that direction and are actually currently in the mortgage application stage right now. So we have that to contend with, obviously continuing to operate our business. But then it's the question of, well, how do we pay back these student loans in the midst of trying to pay our mortgage, in the midst of trying to keep up, just regular childcare and other bills?
Mm-hmm. Well, Chelsea, as you know, I have the perfect person to answer that question for you because Michelle Singletary, who I am still officially calling one of On Point's money ladies, is back with us. Hello, Michelle.
Hello. Thank you for having me again.
I know. It's a slightly unusual for us to have you without Rana Faruhar, but we had her on a couple of weeks ago to talk about jobs. And we've got you back with us, Michelle. She's the nationally syndicated personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. And Michelle also has a new book out. It's a terrific new book. It's called What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, a survival guide. And I feel like it's a guide that we all need. And we've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And Michelle's going to be with us this hour to talk through that survival guide. So, Michelle, what more would you want to know from Chelsea about sort of how to give her advice for the next couple of steps in her life?
Yeah. Well, I'm so sorry all this has happened to you, Chelsea. And I will say, I'm going to get your personal information from the producer, and I'm going to send you a free copy of my new book. I think that's going to really help you. Why do you feel like you need to move out of the apartment right now?
So we're probably at capacity with, it is a 2-bedroom apartment, which we're very lucky for, but two little guys who are basically like puppies that need to run wild, in 1-bedroom. We're also doing it for the schools. Queens has great school districts, but we're moving out to Long Island for some that seem to really match, our kids well. So those are really our top priorities. Obviously they come at a, maybe opposition to our whole financial wellness or financial position, but our kids are definitely our top priority.
So I'm going to ask you another question, and Meghna knows how I am about this, because to give you the best advice, I've got to get a sense of where you are. And I love that you told me your priorities. If you buy a new house, how much are we talking about? What kind of mortgage are you looking at?
Yeah. Well, we were very lucky to have a mom in the picture that is helping us with some of that. So our down has been helped a bit. So right now we're looking at a mortgage, which is about $552,000.
Okay. So you know where I'm going, right, Chelsea? So between your student loan debt and if you take on that new mortgage, you're talking about $1 million or so in debt. I don't want you to do that. And I don't think you should do that. Not right now. Until you get your income stabilized, is your family in New York with you? Your parents? Yeah. Your partner's parents?
Both. Yeah, we're lucky. We have both of them. My mom's in Brooklyn. My mother-in-law's in Queens.
And so, do they have space for you to maybe move in with them?
They most likely do. It's partly the commutability side of things and, you know, and autonomy and personal space.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I were with you and I'm your best friend now, I'm going to say that you need to move in with one of those moms and buckle down and handle because I'm telling you, listen, I'm the parent of three kids. So I get that whole space thing and they're on top of each other and rolling around. Yeah. And last night, my two 20-some-year-olds broke my favorite mug. So I get that you want more space. But honey, I do not want the two of you to take on more debt. Right. Especially as you're building your business, it's very irregular income. And now you're going to take on another huge obligation. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Those two little wee people, they're going to make it okay with that space. You want it for them, but you know what? You got plenty of spaces you could go to outside of the apartment. I'm very concerned about the level of student loan debt you have.
Hey, can we just pretend for a second that the three of us are all sitting around a table having a cocktail talking about this? And Chelsea, I'm going to be your other pretend best friend here. And because Michelle, I also heard Chelsea say she wants to move for the schools. I'm feeling that. I am feeling it. I've made choices in my life for the exact same reason. And Chelsea, by the way, I just want to say I am hearing you, and there's so much mirrored in what you're saying in my life, because I couldn't have been a homeowner if it had not been for assistance from my family also. So, so that plus like wanting to live in a place where the schools were more aligned with what we wanted, like those are powerful. That's a powerful long-term decision made for the betterment of her kids, Michelle. Like, why tell her not to do that?
I am still telling her to do that. And because I did think I heard that the set of parents that they could live in are in good areas. And her kids are 6 and 2. And in those early years, what are they going to need to learn? And also help them teach them, you know, their alphabets, how to, you know, you can read to them. I mean, those years are not the years you have to worry so much about their schooling. They're still so young, and you can supplement that with tutoring. And I get that you want the best school dishes for them. But I'm going to tell you something personally. You know, I grew up in Baltimore. I grew up in the Baltimore City public school system, which has some issues. And guess where I work? I think I work at the Washington Post. I think I turned out okay. And I had people who read to me and did the things in their formative years. And so that is not a concern you need to have right now. Right now, you need to be concerned about that almost $400,000 in student loan debt that you're now going to add to it if you buy that home with another $500,000. And that's going to create such stress for you and your partner. That is going to have a bigger impact on those two kids than coloring at a better school.
Chelsea, how are you feeling about this?
You know, there's, I definitely feel mixed. Maybe I echo the concerns of many, you know, student loan debt is an interesting thing. I do not like to be in debt, and I don't want that weighing on me, but there's something about that, not just the high number, but I feel very jaded about it, meaning I feel, yes, I'm going to chip away and chip away at it, but I feel like I have been doing that and it doesn't move a ton. So it almost seems like I'd be putting my life on hold just to chip away at something that it feels like I'm not even going to really get through. In a substantial
you won't be
way.
Chipping away. Yeah, but you won't be chipping away at it. If you move in with one of your parents and you don't pay rent,
that's a good point.
And I don't know what your rent is, but if you take that several thousand dollars and all the costs that live on your own and apply it to that debt, you could be out of that debt in 5 years.
5 years?
If both of their incomes, the bulk of both of their incomes is attacking that debt and they're living somewhere without a lot of living expenses, they could be out of that debt in 5 years. And how do I know this? It's because this is what I do outside of my day job with the Washington Post. I work in my community and I had a couple in a similar situation. They didn't have as much, but they had about $200,000 and two kids sort of around. They were, you know, young kids, actually two boys too. I put them on, I made them cut their expenses and other couples, I make them live with people and they have gotten out of that debt and 4 to 5 years.
That was my next question in terms of like timeline. If we were to go that route, what you see, but that answers that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you talk to the parents, they won't be, you know, you give them a little bit for the extra utilities, but if you took almost all of your monthly income minus the expenses for your personals, couldn't you see getting rid of that in that time period? And that would give you breathing room to move into that beautiful home without dragging that debt with you.
Wow. Well, you know what, Chelsea, we've got to let you go. But you got a taste there of Michelle Singletary's loving, tough love. And as Michelle said, we'll connect you to her directly after the show for some follow-up and to get her book to you. But Chelsea Horenstein, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Michelle.
Michelle,
thank you. You're welcome.
Hang in there for 1 minute because we're going to talk more about what's in your book and why people need it now just after the break. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'm delighted to tell you that Michelle Singletary is back with us today. She's the personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, and she has a new book out called What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, A Survival Guide. And there will always be a next crisis, won't there, Michelle? So I feel like this book has permanent utility in most American lives.
Yeah, it will be. You know, I was thinking about how to describe the book. And when you hear the crisis in a title, I think it makes people fearful that I'm trying to, you know, make people afraid. But I look at it as with, you know, when you're a fire person and you have all your equipment ready to go at a moment's notice, you hope that there won't be a fire, but you know that there will be. So you got to make sure you have everything lined up. And that's what this book is. And I know that there are people who thought I might be a little harsh on Chelsea, that I crushed her dreams of a new house and a better school district. But here's the thing, folks, you can't do it all at the same time. And she's trying to do it all. And she's got to take it time and line up her equipment, make sure she's prepared, because otherwise things will come crashing down if she doesn't.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, because you mentioned Chelsea again, we actually did get a quick question, which I think is a great one, and I'd love to toss it at you, Michelle. Lindsay's wondering about Chelsea's dreams of home ownership. Isn't buying a home an investment and a place to earn equity regardless of debt?
Well, it can be long term, but we know from the Great Recession that doesn't always happen, that your home greatly appreciates. You should buy your home for a place to live, not for an investment. And here's the other reason why, because when you buy that home, and I say you do build up equity, how do you get access to that? You have to take out another loan. And so simply having the home for them in this part of their life isn't going to build what they need to build, because house, and then they've got all this debt with the home, and they've got all the student loan debt. And then how are they going to save for retirement too? And I want to see those two little kids go to college with no debt. And so home ownership is right at the right time. I've been a homeowner since my, a year out of college. So I'm a big advocate, but when it's right for you, it's not right for them right now.
Look, we could just spend an hour talking about the housing market right now at the moment too, right? Because it's kind of bonkers in a lot of places in this country. But if we can actually just focus on where the economy is right now and how it's, the purported recovery is having a different impact on different people.
That's right.
Because, there are some folks, a small number of folks who have been doing great, right? Because the stock market seems to know no bounds. But along with that, now we're also seeing another thing which I think is worrying to far more Americans, like the possibility of inflation. We're seeing prices go up on kind of basic things, food, construction materials. How do you think through that?
So it's a really wonky time right now. There are millions of people who did quite well, because our spending got cut. In fact, I'm doing a column for Sunday about the fact that millions of people actually paid down their credit card debt during the pandemic because they weren't out eating out, they weren't taking vacations. And so they've actually gotten ahead. And as you always also mentioned, many people saw their retirement accounts bounce back from the beginning of the pandemic and do really well. So those are the folks, the haves, right? Mm-hmm. The have-nots, those who lost their jobs or their income was reduced or they, things are costing more for them with those reduced incomes. And why we're seeing inflation is the supply and demand, right? That a lot of productions got cut down because of, stay-at-home orders. And so there's now a pent-up demand. And when there's a pent-up demand, people are willing to pay anything, and they are raising the prices because of that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's some feel that this will level off, that it won't be so bad because production will ramp up, people will go back to work. But you need to be careful during this period. As you mentioned with housing, because people are now, I feel overpaying. There are, multiple bids and people are foregoing inspections and they're actually even offering money more than the bank would lend them. So they got to bring money to the table, which means a lot of them are going to be just skimping into that house, which means that their budget will not accommodate saving for retirement or saving to send their kids to college or having a cash cushion for the next crisis. Because guess what, folks? There will be another crisis.
Well, I just want to ask you one more quick thing about inflation, because we got a question from Mike, who lives in Orlando, and he's particularly worried about the potential for hyperinflation. He says because of all the government spending that we've been seeing over the course of the pandemic, and he's wondering how that's going to affect his retirement, and here's what he asked.
My question for Michelle Singletary has to do with inflation. I have invested in index funds, mutual funds, for the better part of 20 years, maxing out my 401k. However, given the fact that 40% of the U.S. currency has been printed in the last year, I feel like hyperinflation is on the way. and more risky investing behavior is necessary. Things like individual stocks or cryptocurrency to prepare for our money being devalued.
So, Michelle, you ready to dive headfirst into crypto?
I don't worry about that at all. I mean, we hear a lot of the news about cryptocurrency, but the fact of the matter is most investors are not in this. It's very speculative. And so it's great news. It makes great headlines. But the average person, first of all, doesn't even know what it is. So I'm not worried about that at all. You know, the Fed is keeping an eye on this, right? Interest rates are still fairly low. You're seeing a lot of this inflation because people were home. They weren't spending and production was down. And if things go the way it should, that the inflation will be in check soon enough. And even if it does rise, there are all kinds of tools that the Fed has to help make sure that we are okay. So I am not worried at all about my investments. I'm in it for the long haul. I'm taking other precautions. Like one of the ways to fight inflation is maybe you switch out things that you would normally buy. Maybe you hold off on some projects until prices stabilize. So there are things that you can do as an individual to combat that. Watch your spending. Make sure you don't have a lot of debt. And I think that you will be just fine. I'm not worried at all about inflation right now.
Okay, so Michelle Singletary not going to invest in NFTs or Bitcoin. I hear you, but let's get the big picture here, because you write in your book that you manage your finances as if you're in a perpetual recession. So concretely, why? And concretely, what does that mean?
Why? Because I'm insane. You know that. I'm a fiscal conservative. And what I mean by that, again, and I just really want to say, I'm not talking about I'm fearful all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm a realist. We get through these crises. We get through recessions and downturns. And then we sort of forget the lessons of the last recession. And we go right back to our spending. We go right back to living beyond our means. And so what I say is that I have to constantly talk to myself. And you know how frugal I am.
Yeah.
So I have to constantly say, Michelle, when you earn more, that doesn't mean that you start spending more. Michelle, when you get that raise, put it into the kids' college fund. This is my fourth book. And I was just telling my eldest, who is living with us, that when I got my money for my first book, you know what I did with most of that money? I put it in her college fund. Mm-hmm. And so because I didn't want her to have debt at that time as an infant, I didn't know that she wanted to be a social worker, therapist, making not a great amount of money. But now that I know that that's the career she chose, I'm so grateful that my child doesn't have any student loan debt so she can do what she was gifted to do, which is serve people. And so when I say I live in a recession, that's what I'm talking about. My husband and I do not live on all of our income. We probably live on maybe about 60%. We tie to our church and we save the rest of it. That's really what I mean by living in recession. I try to make sure that I recognize that there could be another economic downturn. My husband could lose his job. I could lose my job. And I just want to be sure that just like that fire person is prepared, that engine is ready, that those hoses are intact, so that if there is a financial fire, I'm ready for mm-hmm. it.
Well, so the equation is actually pretty simple, right? And this is the advice that you've been giving people for your entire career. And it's just, you know, save more than you spend, right?
Yeah.
But I think the challenge that so many Americans feel is that as hard as they try, because just, you know, the fact of their overall income, there's nothing left to save.
So
we've got a question here from a listener named Alyssa, who called us from Madison, Wisconsin. She's 32, and here's how she puts it.
I guess my biggest question is really just how to prepare for that crisis. It seems inevitable that some level of crisis or emergency is going to happen. It feels like it always does. In the last 3 months alone, my husband needed a root canal that we found out wasn't actually covered under our dental insurance plan. Also found out our dog needs a $4,000 surgery, and all of this right as we finally had the stars aligned for purchasing a home after looking for over a year. So we're now feeling a money crunch that we really didn't think that we would be feeling right now. And we do save. We are both lucky enough to be able to contribute to retirement accounts through both of our jobs. And we do have automatic transfers set up into personal savings accounts each month. But then things come up and you pull a little here and a little there and then you pay yourself back. And it just seems like we can never quite get over that hill when it comes to savings.
So, Michelle, I think when Alyssa says that hill, I think it's like that quite get over the hill to feeling secure, right? In the long run, using your fireman analogy, right? Like knowing that you've got the safety gear there no matter when you might need it. So how does someone like that manage these situations?
Well, she's managing. I mean, she said, we pull it out, we put it back in. That's exactly what is happening. She's doing exactly what I suggest people do. And anxiety is that when you have to pull that money, you know, you kind of want to just watch it and have it stay there. But that's that money's purpose. I like to joke that I'm a pot person, but not that kind of pot. I have all kinds of pots. So I have a pot. I've got a little dog. And the other day he started limping. And I was like, oh, Lord. And it turns out it was okay. I think he might have just hit it on something. It was sore. But I was thinking, oh, man, I got to take him and look at his limp leg. And that's going to cost $400 or $500. But guess what? I got a dog pot. And it sounds like Alicia has that as well. And many people do. So you don't want to run your life on that anxiety. She's doing exactly what she's doing, saving for retirement. They've got an emergency fund. They've got life funds because she said they were pulling from it. Mm-hmm. Those are the lucky ones. She's actually very fortunate. But I understand that there's always this anxiety because life happens, right? Things happen that you don't plan for. It's the folks who don't even have that cushion, who don't have the ability that I worry the most about. And they have to do things a little differently, right? They may have to have shared housing situations, because housing is your biggest expense. And I'm an advocate for that, multi-generational households, so that when life happens, the dog gets, you know, has an issue, or you have an reimbursable dental bill, there's money there to pay for that. And it doesn't send you crashing down.
But you know, the thing about Alyssa is, if she's hearing this now, I hope she's feeling good, because Michelle says you're doing the right things, Alyssa. But I also, I really understand she still has that level of anxiety, though, right? Because this is the thing about American life, that even if you're able to save a little and have that cushion and maybe be somewhat prepared for the next crisis, there's so much that's been dumped on individual Americans.
That's
right. Healthcare, retirement, all of it, that it's almost impossible to not feel anxious about your financial security. So what do you...
You're absolutely right.
Yeah,
you're
go ahead.
Absolutely right. And I feel that too, and I'm doing exceptionally well. And that's where policy comes into place. That's where we have to also fight on the front of making sure that healthcare is covered and not tied to people's jobs, so that when they lose a job, they lose healthcare. We have to make sure that that safety net is truly a safety net, and that within that safety net, we help people, you know, get better jobs, better education, that's where policy comes into place. Let's help people get a college education so they don't have decades of debt like Chelsea and her partner. So that's where the policy comes into place. And how you vote and who you vote for, are those folks making sure that they are putting things in place so that you don't feel so anxious when life happens? Mm-hmm.
So in the book, and again, it's What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, you kind of, in the beginning, you walk people through a way of thinking about how to prioritize life, right? And then decide, you know, speaking of the pots that you were talking about, how to apportion what you've got along those priorities. So can you just walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, so many people hear about having just an emergency fund and they focus on that, but you need a couple of different types of pots. And so the emergency fund, I look at it as more the dire fund. You've lost your job. Perhaps you have to take off to take care of a sick child or a relative or your parents. And so that's money there to replace that income. So the life happens pot is things like Alicia talked about, your dog having to do a root canal. You're going to put money in there as much as you can, as often as you can. It may start off with just $25, but eventually maybe it'll be $2,000. And then I actually think you ought to have a pot to help other people. So my husband and I have a family and friends pot so that when they lose their jobs or they some issues with them that we can pull from that doesn't impact our financial standing. It helps them. And then, of course, the retirement pot. And that's kind of how you reduce some of the anxiety. You set your life up like that. Now, what we found with this pandemic, that even people who did all of that, they had all the pots. They lost their job. They ran through all the pots. It's okay, because at least you had something to help you with. And then that's after the pandemic, let's rebuild you back up. Because some of us, many people, no matter how much they save, there could be an emergency that hits you that just takes you out. But then you just have to get back up. And that's what happened in the pandemic. And I don't want them to feel guilty that somehow they didn't save enough. Somehow they didn't, you know, they went out to eat one extra time that they shouldn't have. Don't feel that way, because this pandemic was horrendous. There's nothing you could do. I could not have survived this long, even with the way I save, if both of us lost our job in our household. We probably could, because we've been working for 30 some years, but you get my point.
Yeah.
That if you get takedown and you've done all the right things, then that's okay. Don't beat yourself up.
All right. Well, Michelle, hang on here for just a second, because we're going to hear from another listener when we come back, who is eager to get your advice again on how to survive what for many people feels like, to use another listener's term, a perma recession in their lives. So we'll be back with that. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about Major League Baseball and sports gambling. Michelle, don't get mad at me, because we're going to talk about gambling tomorrow. But we're going to talk about how the legalization of sports gambling might be changing baseball. So we want to hear from baseball fans. Do you worry about the game's integrity? Have you wagered any money on baseball games? Again, not necessarily condoning it, Michelle, but we know it's out there and it's legal now. So we want to hear from folks who have engaged in sports betting in baseball and people who wonder about how that might change the game. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking with Michelle Singletary, the nationally syndicated personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. She's got a terrific new book out for, I would say, basically almost all Americans, called What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, A Survival Guide. All right, Michelle, let me just ask you one or two quick questions of kind of specific things that we've been getting, but I think they apply to a lot of people. And then we're going to hear from another listener. But folks want to know, right now, with that freeze on student loan payments and the interest rate frozen at 0%, should people be paying down that debt right now, or instead taking what they would have paid to student loans and putting it into savings?
So if you still have lost your job and you don't have any income, take advantage of that. That gives you some breathing room. You're going to need that money for other necessities, you know, roof over your head, food on the table. If you still have your same job and your income and you're doing well, absolutely attack that student loan debt. I would continue to make those payments, because here's why. Even that other debt that you would attack, that debt has some interest rates with it. This debt There's no interest on it. So every dollar that you pay towards that student loan debt goes directly to the principal, reducing that debt. I would take advantage of that during this period right now.
Okay. Then a lot of people are wondering about when it's okay to dip into their 401ks. Like, for example, a listener wrote us, they're in their 60s, they have about $20,000 in a 401k, $10,000 in savings, $10,000 in credit card debt. The listener plans on working past the age of 70. But should they use some of that 401k money to pay off the credit card debt?
I actually would not, because if they pull that 20 out, I think the listener, did you say the age? Did they say how old
60s.
They were?
60s. They're in their 60s.
60s, right. So they're no longer subject to the 10% with early withdrawal period, but they still got to pay income taxes on that. Mm-hmm. So I actually would take $10,000 or maybe even eight, maybe leave some cushion unless they've got other pots of cushion, and pay off that credit card debt, because that credit card debt is probably around 16%. Maybe it's 12, but most likely 16 to 20 some percent. And that money sitting in savings is earning practically nothing, mm-hmm. especially with the rise in inflation. So you're actually losing money by keeping it in that savings account. So all things being equal, they've got, you know, job security, or they've got their expenses covered, and they're not sort of worried about some major expense happening, I would take it out and chop off that credit card debt. And all the money that they would use to pay that payments every month, then build that savings back up. But I wouldn't touch that retirement money.
Got it. Okay. So use the money that you're not getting any interest on in savings, at least a little bit of that, and pay down that very high interest rate credit card debt. Good
Absolutely.
Advice. Okay. So I'd like to introduce you now to Delois Robison. She lives in Detroit, and we actually featured Delois on a show that we did about retirement a little while ago. Delois, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Hello, good morning, good afternoon, evening, wherever, whatever it is where you are, and how is everybody? I knew I was going to make that. I got a big note in front of me. I knew I was going to make a mistake. Don't say good morning, afternoon, and that's the first thing out of my mouth. But anyway, hello, everybody.
Hello,
how are you?
Delois, no matter where people are, they hear your hearty hello. So that's all that we care about. Now, Michelle, Delois is 70. She's retired. Her husband passed away, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And on our retirement show, she told us about the financial impact that a series of these really challenging moments in her life had. Delois, do you want to just tell Michelle a little bit about what you've been experiencing recently?
Yes, I would. Thank you. I am, as you say, retired. I retired from education and social work type programs when I was 55, because I had a heart attack. And I had worked in that field since 1979, and so I'm talking about around 2005 or so. And when I had the heart attack, it had slowed me down, so I had to slow down my work. And so with that, my husband and I started our own business, and things were fine with that, because I still had an income, and he had an income. We were both fairly healthy, even though I'd had a heart attack. And so we were working, and I felt that my life was doable for until I was ready to go on Social Security. But then I had a second heart attack within a couple of years after that. And with that, I was just not able to work outside of the home at all. And so our income was strictly my husband's, that was our self-employment, because we owned our own business. And so that went along. That was like 2005 or so. In 2016, my husband passed away. And so that whole half of the income went away. And I was incapacitated. I was no longer able to do the kind of work that I was known for, that people were calling me to do, that I was being well paid for. I was no longer being called or able to do that because of my health. And so this happened, and I had to turn to my Social Security, our savings, and eventually my 401k, and eventually other savings, and eventually my house, and eventually other savings, and this is because of medical debt not covered by Medicare, and also the fact that when I was working, I made $15 more then I was qualified for Medicaid. Mm. So that left me with a $600 a month copay before I could get any help from Medicaid. Now, understand that my income, I pay 71% of my income for rent. Mm. So there's no money to come out of there for Medicaid. I know $600 a month. There's no money for that. So what I have learned, and I am in a category different from some of the other people who are calling in or that you're interviewing, I am poor. I am completely poor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody recognizes that. Social Security recognizes that. Our food stamp system recognizes that. We have free food programs here in Detroit. I get meals from them. I belong to a senior citizens organization. Thank God I got a food box from them. Yeah. So when I hear people talking about, I'm 70, yeah. and I do have challenges with my health, but I do expect to be here a little longer. And however it goes, I don't have money to do what I need to do. So what am I facing right now? Well, more health problems, because just yesterday I had another procedure.
Mm.
And I'm talking about peripheral artery disease and triple bypasses and things like that. So these are things that are not, I'm not choosing to have these. These are things where the doctor looked at the thing and said, okay, we got to get you in here tomorrow.
Dolores, do you mind if I just step in here for a little bit? Forgive me for doing that. I'm so glad that you were willing to come back and share your story with us. But just can you quickly let me know, like, what do you want? What's your question for Michelle about your situation now?
Okay, and I appreciate what Michelle said, I think it was Michelle, who talks earlier about policy. Because for me and millions of Americans now, we're down to policy. We're down to politics.
Mm.
People like me, we have not chosen to be in this position. But we're in this position because, for example, one thing, the whole rubric that they use for determining who qualifies for Medicaid and how much, and who qualifies for Medicare and how much, it is completely outdated in consideration for the kinds of things that people face today, especially the kinds of medical expenses that people... So, and everybody knows that that's out of whack. Everybody knows that Medicare is not paying anybody enough money to be healthy. And that copay that we have, that is what... When I talk about medical debt, I was able to get a triple bypass surgery, PAD surgeries three times, because Medicare covers the major part, but they don't cover the whole thing.
Right. So Michelle, Michelle, go ahead. I'm sure you've got a lot on your mind.
Yeah, I do. There's two things. So, have you looked into the spend down program for Medicaid in your state? So, if you probably need to be requalified, because you may actually be qualified for Medicaid in addition to Medicare. So, hopefully, you're meeting with a Medicaid specialist in your state to look at your finances.
Let me answer that, because that's part of the problem. Yes, I qualify for Medicaid if my medical expenses are over $600 a month, and if I pay that $600 first.
Right.
Okay. Go back to I pay 71% of my income just to have a place to live.
Okay, so let's start right there. So because that's part of the analysis that just gets you on Medicaid. So you're renting, you said right now, right?
Yes.
Did you say you're renting? Okay. So can we find another place for you to live, even if it's shared housing?
Well, I'm living in shared housing now.
And so you're living with someone and you're still paying 71%?
Yes. Out of my income, they're paying. They're all on Social Security also and what have you. But there are four people. We are all seniors. We have a four family home. We are actually having to leave this home now by September because the landlord is going up on the rent. But yes, my rent is 75% of my income, and I already live with four other people and share the rent.
Okay, so then it still means that where you're living is too expensive.
Yes.
So do you have family? I don't think you have children, but do you have, nieces, aunties, other people that you can reach out to try to help get that housing cost down?
That's who I'm living with. I'm living with four sisters.
I know.
Their children are on their children. I understand where you're going because I heard your report earlier.
Yeah.
And I wrote down all these things you said, and all these things you said, they just don't apply to me. My nieces and nephews and grandnieces and nephews are on welfare. You know, there are different words for it in different states. But
they are
on what amounts to plain welfare. They're on EBT. They don't have transportation. I can't get them to come over here and do things for me. So I don't have housekeeping. I can't get them to drive me around because they don't have cars.
Yeah.
So, Michelle, I'm not saying that what you're saying is not. That's why I'm saying that this has to be dealt with at a policy level.
I want to help you where you are now while we wait for that policy to kick in. So I'm going to need you to talk to that. There's in every state there is a senior or elderly care department within the state government. I'm going to try to send you some information through the producer so that you can talk to someone that we can look at some more housing options for you. That is one of the keys for you right now. Now, 71% of your income is extremely high. You want to try to get it down to, I mean, technically, it should really be in a 30% range. But even, you know, let's try to even get it down to 40 or 50%. So that may mean some other housing situation in a two-bedroom apartment, you know, where you can, or applying for housing, public housing vouchers or something like that. So let's talk about, I think we need to get you with a social worker in your state to look at other housing options for you, because that's where we're going to find the money for you to reduce your costs so that you then can get into that spend down program for Medicaid.
Okay. Again, I understand what you're saying, and that's exactly where I am right now. I've just applied. Because in our state, that thing is called the Area Agency on Aging.
Okay.
And so I just had them to send me a list of all of the residences that are covered by Section 8, that are subsidized housing, so that my sisters and I can look through all of them and see which ones of them have vacancies. Now, I understand and know that they've warned me that they all, some of them have a year of a waiting list or more.
Yeah.
So there, you know, we have that. So, but I appreciate everything you're saying. I'm not saying what you're saying is not good.
No, it sounds like you're taking all the steps.
And that's why I'm frustrated. That's why I've got this tone in my voice. I'm just frustrated because go ahead. I'm sorry.
I understand
your frustration. I do. And I work with people like you all the time in my community. And I will say, not just to you, but to other people who are listening, that I hope that you can find someone within your sphere, maybe through your church or community organization that you belong to, who can take you in and live with them without either charging you rent or very little amount. That's how I do it. When someone like you, if you were one of my relatives, my husband would take you in and we would not charge you rent and you'd be okay. My sister came to live with me for 3 years after a really bad divorce. Didn't charge her rent so she could get back on her feet. So I'm hoping that you can find someone in your life. Mm-hmm. And it might not be with your sisters, who can say, hey, Dolores, you're a wonderful woman. Come live with me. And I say that, and I know people are listening like, I can't believe you're telling her that. But what else can I tell her if she's already doing all the things that you're supposed to do? She's trying to apply for public housing. She's trying to figure out, you know, the Medicaid situation. So that's where those who you are listening come in. You need to look around in your life. Who can you help while we try to get this policy thing working?
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, Dolores, you're going to have to forgive me because I have 30 seconds before I got to wrap up this show. But thank you so much, Dolores Robinson, for coming back.
Thank you very much. That you appreciate what I've said and you passed on just the right advice to all of us.
Yeah, because you got us to the right place, which is, Michelle, you know, your column is about personal finance, things that individuals can do on an individual level to try to stay out of the situations that the systems thrust them in. And that's advice we should all take. And at the same time, got to work to change the system that makes so many Americans so vulnerable all the time. But Michelle Singletary, the new book is What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, a Survival Guide. We've got an excerpt at onpointradio.org. Michelle, it's always so good to have you on the show. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, well, I so appreciate you having me. I love talking to you and your listeners, and I do hope I've helped somebody.
You have, for sure. And you will again when we have you back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.